Hi, good morning. Hi, welcome. It's good to be in my comfort zone again. I want to start by addressing just one thing that some of you brought up. So I know it's at least on some of your minds. The article that was assigned for this week by David Myers on the idea of fake it till you make it, the behavior changing attitude. Remember self-perception theory? We often derive ideas about ourselves from the way we see ourselves. And I wanted to differentiate it again. I've done it before. Differentiate it again from the great deception. What David Myers is saying is not, you know, be there with a smile all the time or act optimistic as happy people do all the time. But what he's saying is that sometimes we're able to get out of the rut. Sometimes we're able to get out of negative emotional state by behaving as if we're happy. For example, I really don't feel like going out tonight, I'm tired, I'm upset. But very often when we do go, initially put on a smile, we often feel better as a result. Not always, but often. So it's not the great deception, but once in a while it can be helpful. The other thing that I want to clarify for those of you who have already read the article, David Myers talks about characteristics of happy people, and one of the characteristics that he talks about is extroversion. And he says, act like an extrovert if you want to be happy. That's where I take issue with his theory. I agree with just about everything that he says, except for that. I don't think the issue is extroversion. The issue is social support. So even if you're an introvert and you have one friend, or an extrovert and have, you know, 1,600 friends, the main point is that you have the friends and then you have the social support. It's not whether you're an extrovert or an introvert. I don't think that is really what matters for us to be happy, but we do need social support. And extroverts perhaps are more likely to seek social support. Introverts are more likely to close in and be by themselves. And even if we reach out to one person or two people, that in and of itself can make us feel much better, much more comfortable in our own skins. Going back to the material. Before we go into goal setting, which to my mind is one of the most important issues or ideas that you can take away from this course. Maybe not as exciting because it's quite technical. I'm gonna go into the nitty-gritties of how do you set goals. But it's significant, it's important, because that's the image of success. The vision that we have of ourselves, of what we wanna look like 1 year from now, 10 years, 50 years from now. What do we want our lives to look like? And it's very often the image that we have. Remember, the mind looks for consistency between what is inside and what is outside. It's that image that often creates our reality. So I'm going to talk about goal setting, but before I go into that, I want to finish up on the lecture on change. Remember where we left last time, where I shared with you two studies, two phenomenal studies, one by Jamie Pennebaker, the other by Laura King. Jamie Pennebaker, what he showed, that bringing in people to journal for 20 minutes on four consecutive days about traumas or difficult experiences that they had actually increased their, or decreased their base level of anxiety. It meant that over the next 6 months, they visited the doctor's office less often than a control group, just by four times intervention of 20 minutes each time. Writing about difficult experiences. Remarkable results. People were happier, were smiling more, those people who went through this intervention, making a case for journaling. The second article, which was much more surprising to many people, because after all, we know therapy in general helps. So if you write about difficult experiences, what are you doing? You know, you have your computer or your journal as the therapist. But it's a bit more surprising, the findings by Laura King from UCLA. And what she found was that if we write about our peak experiences, the best moments, the response paper that you had for this week, It has similar effects. We're healthier and happier as a result of that. That's remarkable, unexpected. And the question that psychologists, not just Pennebaker and King, asked was, why? What's at work here? What's going on? What's the process that makes journaling so helpful? What is the mechanism? And they came up with two issues. Again, we still don't really understand it. We just know that it works. The fact that it works is significant because so very few interventions work, as we know. So there are a couple of mechanisms that they came up with. One, it's just a release of tension. This has been around since Freud and before. When we repress an emotion, an idea, we pay a price for it. And what we're doing when we are writing about it, we're releasing it, we're letting go, we're giving ourselves the permission to also be upset or to be happy, ecstatic even. And when we give ourselves this permission, it releases anxiety. As we saw, anxiety, stress connected to our immune system. Remember we talked about it earlier on? And hence we're healthier. Daniel Wagner, professor here, has done work that you will read after spring break about ironic processing, showing that we pay a price when we repress an idea or a feeling. So that's the first mechanism at work. The second mechanism that they came up with is coherence. We all want to make sense of our experiences, of our world. Now, a peak experience or a traumatic experience is a packed experience. How do we unpack it? Well, we can do it by writing about it. Make sense of it, tell a story about it. What Pennebaker found in the journals when he content analyzed them. In content analysis, the field that was introduced by Professor Phil Stone, taking large amounts of data and finding patterns in that data. And what Jamie Pennebaker did was he found a pattern in the people who actually benefited the most from journaling. And the pattern was that they had a lot of quote-unquote understandings. They used a lot the word, I see, now I understand that, I realize that, this means that. In other words, they made sense of what previously was just mumble-jumble of senseless experiences. So it's these two mechanisms that are at work. Pennebaker, an artifact of our ambiguous and unpredictable world is the anxiety of not attaining completion and not understanding a simple cause and effect explanation for traumatic disturbances. Alas, we naturally search for meaning and the completion of events. It gives us a sense of control and predictability over our lives. This is what journaling does. I know many of you keep journals, I keep a journal, and you know by the end of a session, you feel better because, that makes sense now. Even if it was a bad experience, we're able to derive some meaning from it through writing. So these are the two reasons that have been identified. There may be many others that we don't know about. I keep a journal. My journal on my computer is password protected. No one sees it, even though I have no secrets there, certainly not from my wife. I still make it a point that I show nobody. Why? Because I know when I sit down, I can write about everything and anything. It's a very comfortable, safe space for me when I go through difficult or great experiences. I write it. There are some people who like to write every day, and the only journal I keep every day is the gratitude journal, as you know. It helps a lot. And again, those of you who keep a journal don't need the research to tell you how helpful it is or can be. So let me summarize the lecture of change. We talked about the channels that we have, literally the channels that we have in our brains, neural pathways. And what we said is that when we want to change these habits, because remember John Dryden, we first make our habits, and then our habits make us. If we want to change habits, if we want a change effort to overcome the flood of habit, we need to channel it deeply. And to channel it deeply, we want to use the ABCs. The affect, our emotions, the behaviors, taking action. Remember, the people who benefit most from workshops or seminars are not the people who just say, oh, that's a great idea, I got it, but it's people who follow up with immediate behavior. And finally, cognition, understanding. Let's take an example of how these three work in tandem. Take, for instance, self-esteem. I have low self-esteem, a low evaluation of myself. That's the cognitive part. As a result of that, my emotion, my affect will be low. I'm less likely to want to get out and act. If I'm less likely to go out and act, i.e. affecting my behavior, I will also feel even worse about myself because I've done nothing. I have avoided as opposed to coped. I didn't ask or I didn't try out for a play. And remember self-perception theory, I see myself as someone with low self-esteem because of how I behave, and I feel even worse, and I behave or I act even less, I think even less, and so on in a downward spiral. The same can apply the other direction. I have high self-esteem. I think highly of myself. This is going to motivate me. It's going to make me feel more excited and ready to act. I'm much more likely to act, to get out of my comfort zone, to take risks, to cope. And then I see myself behaving like a person with high self-esteem, self-perception. I think even higher of myself as a result. My affect, even more motivated, and so on in an upward spiral. The nice thing about this model is that it's cyclical. In other words, we can intervene anywhere. We can intervene by focusing on our emotions, by focusing on our behavior, or by focusing on our way of thinking. Ideally, all three. Let me share with you a personal example. One of the things, as you know, that I've been dealing with from the time I remember myself, is a low threshold for anxiety. I startle very easily. I get very nervous, as you know, in front of audiences. In squash, I would often choke when I would play tournaments, especially big games. So this was an issue that I've been dealing with for a very long time. And I wanted to change it with one of my goals, one of my objectives. So let me tell you what I did, how I approached it, understanding the ABCs, which I got from my introductory social psychology class here as an undergrad. So, affect. How did I directly focus on my emotions? A few ways. One, exercise. Exercise, as we'll talk about after spring break, has the effect of an anti-anxiety pill and antidepressant in one. So exercise regularly. The second thing, yoga, combining both mind and body, very much relaxed me. Music, from Whitney Houston to Michael Jackson. Again, the whole gamut of great music. The music that relaxes me, which you get to hear at the beginning of every class. As for behavior, I would get out of my comfort zone. So here as an undergrad, I made a point of speaking up in section, even though I was shy, even though every time when I was planning to speak up, I couldn't hear the other students speaking because the only thing I could hear was my heart beating in my head. I think those of you who are introverts may be able to identify with that. The extroverts don't know what I'm talking about. That's behavioral change. I started speaking up in front of people, initially my roommates, then the squash team, then larger audiences. That was the behavioral change that I introduced, and also cognitive change through cognitive therapy, through understanding and learning to cognitively reconstruct situations. Remember, moving more toward the optimism rather than the pessimism side, but all these things working together. And overarching, beyond all this, giving myself the permission to be human, allowing myself to be anxious, allowing myself to be nervous. Because remember, there are two kinds of people who don't experience any anxiety or nervousness or sadness: the psychopaths and the dead people. And I was so happy to be alive, and not to be a psychopath, of course. Let me summarize with a quote by Henry David Thoreau. I know of no more encouraging fact than the unquestionable ability of man to elevate his life by conscious endeavor. It is something to be able to paint a particular picture or to carve a statue, and so to make a few objects beautiful. But it is far more glorious to carve and paint the very atmosphere and medium through which we look, which morally we can do, to affect the quality of the day. That is the highest of arts. It is also, as the field of psychology would contend, the highest, or at least one of the highest, of sciences. This is exactly what we're doing here. Any questions before I move on to goal setting? Any questions about the change lecture or anything else? Okay, yes. Yeah. Good question. So this cycle of the affect, behavior, cognition, this is a simplification. There are actually arrows between and among the three components. So there would, yeah, so there would be, I guess, six arrows, three factorial, so in every direction. Because just like behavior affects cognition, my cognition also affects my behavior. It doesn't necessarily have to go through the emotion. Good point. Anything else? Okay, let me move to goal setting. Because goal setting is very much about identifying where is it that I want to change. What is my image of success? Where do I want to be? Whether it's next week, in terms of my weekly plan, or whether it's 30 years from now, in terms of my job, career, or calling. So what we're going to talk about in the next two lectures are the theory and practice of both identifying the right goals and also achieving these goals. So the end and also the process of getting there. We're going to talk a little bit about time management. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time to do that, but just a few tips about, just a few tips about how we can make better use of our time. I'm going to talk about two issues, which I'll get to in a minute. And finally, we're going to talk about much larger issue of creating an internal, and ultimately, hopefully, if enough people make this internal, an external revolution of moving from material perception to happiness perception. And I'll elaborate on this next in the next lecture. We won't get to it today. Before I start, I have a question for you. Two questions. One, whomever here wants to procrastinate less and be more efficient, please put your hand up. Okay, that's one or two, or 855, okay. All right, second question. Please put your hand up if you want to be, to experience less stress, to be less overwhelmed, other than me. Okay. Now, if you put up your hand for one of these questions, you should stay for the lecture. Otherwise, you know it. If you put up your hand for the two questions, you should not only stay, you should also stay awake. So let's proceed. First thing I want to talk about is, why are goals important? Why do we set goals? It takes a lot of time, a lot of effort. And as we know, we don't have much extra time, certainly not here. So why do we set goals? First of all, it's for performance, and later I'll talk also about well-being in terms of our levels of happiness. Let me begin with performance. What goals do is they focus us. They focus us on where we want to go. And what that does, in the words of Abraham Maslow, being focused on a task produces organization for efficiency both within the organism and in the environment. Those of you taking 1508, Psychology of Leadership, know how much we talk about. Organizations that have goals are much more successful in the long run, and ambitious goals. Individuals who have goals, explicit goals, I mean, we all have implicit goals, but who have goals and actually write them down, and we'll talk about research that shows that writing them down has a positive impact on our levels of success. It also makes us more resilient. If we have a goal that we strive for, that we want, that we care about, we're much more likely to overcome the vicissitudes of the process of the journey, and there inevitably are ups and downs. Remember the research on resilience that we talked about in the second class? One of the critical elements of resilient kids is that they have long-term goals, either that they came up with themselves or were helped to come up with it by their teachers. Another reason why goals are so significant goes back to our discussion of beliefs as self-fulfilling prophecies. Imagine this. You're going on a road trip. You have your knapsack, your backpack on you. And you walk and you walk and you walk, and the journey is wonderful and great and everything is going smooth. And then you hit a brick wall. That always happens. Inevitable. No one has a smooth journey throughout life. You hit a brick wall and you have a few choices. One choice is to turn away and to avoid the brick wall. Because after all, if I don't try, I'm not gonna fail. I don't wanna fail. I'm gonna look stupid if I fall. Turn around. One other way to approach it, and we'll talk a lot about this very brick wall when we talk about perfectionism. Another way to approach this brick wall is to take our knapsack off our back and to throw it over. To throw it over. And you know what? Then we don't have a choice. We have to get over that wall. How we do it, I don't know yet. We may have to break it with a hammer. We may have to try and climb over it and fall and try again. We may have to ask for help from our friends or family. We may find a way around it or under it. I don't know, but if we throw our knapsack, we're much more likely to get over it. You know why? Because necessity is the mother of inventions. That's how it works. That's how it works in reality. When we make that commitment, we're much more likely to do it. Think about what did Roger Bannister do with the 4-minute mile? What, I can't make the 4-minute mile? Let me show you. I threw my knapsack, I'm gonna do it. And then he broke the brick wall. How did he break it? With his mind. Thomas Edison, he didn't know how he was gonna make it, how he was gonna create light from electricity. He was still failing, remember his 10,000 failures on the way. He said, on this date, I'm gonna show the world how I can generate light from electricity. Boom, knapsack. And the mind doesn't like when there is inconsistency between what is outside in the real world and what is inside in our mind. Our words create worlds. What we commit to, what we say we'll do, very often creates the reality. Think about even little things. Let's say you're looking for a computer. And you say, I'm looking for a computer. You're setting a goal that you want a computer. Suddenly you start seeing many more ads, whether it's on the bus or in the newspaper. Suddenly you see more computer shops that suddenly came up over the last 24 hours. That happens because we're focused on it. And our mind doesn't like when there is a disconnect between what's inside our commitments and what outside, what actually transpires in the real world. the etymological connection between concept and conceive is metaphysical. It's real. We see it in theology, we see it in scientific research, in psychology. In the Bible, God says, let there be light. Words or concepts conceive, words create worlds. The book of John begins with, in the beginning there was the Word. This country was declared into existence. Words have enormous power, organizationally, when we set a vision, and personally, when we set a vision or a goal for ourselves. I want to read you a quote. It's quite a long quote, but it's a quote that I have on my wall, one of the primings that I have. It's by W.H. Murray. Some of you may have encountered it. He led the Scottish expedition to the Himalayas in the 50s. Concerning all acts of creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves in too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would not have otherwise occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance, which no man would have dreamed would come his way. I've learned a deep respect for one of Goethe's couplets. Whether you can do or dream you can do, begin it. Boldness has genius, magic, and power in it. And I think that quote has power in it because it is so true. When we commit, whether you believe in God or whether you believe in the power of the mind, things begin to happen. That's the way it works. And there's a lot of research to back that up and a lot of anecdotes. Whether it's Edison, Bannister, Anita Roddick, Jack Welch, who will all tell you this, you have an idea, go with it. Marva Collins knew that, she knows that, and she applies it day in and day out, teaching. Goals only don't only improve our performance in terms of success, they also make us happier, but only goals properly understood. What do I mean by that, by properly understood? Because we know that achieving goals doesn't really make us happier in the long run. You know, we know Professor Gilbert's work on effective forecasting. We go back to our base level very quickly after, you know, we get a great grade, or after we win the lottery, or after we get tenure. Very quickly we go back to our base level. So goals understood that way don't really make us happy. And that's how most people understand goals. If I achieve this, then I'll be happy. So what do I mean by goals properly understood? The proper understanding is that goals can and ought to be liberating. What do I mean? Let's go back to the road trip. We've thrown the knapsack, we got over the brick wall, and we walk. Now, if I've no idea where I'm going, if I don't know the direction in which I'm going, I will have to constantly look at my map, look a step ahead to see that I'm not falling over a cliff, make sure that I have the right orientation. I will be distracted by not knowing where I'm going. However, if I know where I'm going, I have a clear sense of direction. I can enjoy the flowers on the side. I can enjoy the journey because I don't need to worry about where I'm going. In other words, a long-term goal liberates me to enjoy the here and now, the process. The emphasis, and I talk about this in my book, and what you'll be reading for this week, the emphasis in my theory is not on the attainment of goals, but rather on having goals. That is the key issue. In other words, goals are means. Present experiences are ends. The goal is the mean that I have, that I use, in order to make my present experience more pleasant, more enjoyable. Because we know that achieving the goals will only lead to a spike in our level of well-being, or not achieving a goal, maybe to a negative spike. But that ultimately will not increase the base level. The base level is in the here and now. It's the present. It's also our gift, and we need to learn to make the best of it. And we do that by having long-term goals that liberate us to enjoy the here and now. This misunderstanding, the misunderstanding of the appropriate role of goals explains partially why so many highly successful people are unhappy and why they end up, in many cases, turning to drugs or alcohol for them to get out of their negative moods. And the reason is because they, like most people in the world, and know that once we get to a certain place, then we'll be happy. Once I become famous, once I become rich, once I get this promotion, then I'll be happy. And they struggle and struggle. They're not happy along the way, but they are driven by this belief. Now, once I get into Harvard, then I'll be happy. Once I get my dream job, consulting job, investment banking, not-for-profit, get into the med school, business school, whatever, then I'll be happy. And they're sustained by this belief, like most people are. And then they get there. And what do they find out? That there is no there there. And then they don't know what to do. Then they experience resignation, because what is there then in life? I was always sustained, unhappy, but at least sustained by the belief that I'll get to the goal. And then they turn very often try to escape from reality, because reality can't afford them the happiness that they believe, that we all believe, is attainable in this world. The proper role of goals is to facilitate the enjoyment of the present. From my book, happiness is not about making it to the peak of the mountain, nor is it about climbing aimlessly around the mountain. Happiness is the experience of climbing toward the peak. We can't really be happy. I don't believe we can really be happy, and research would confirm that, if we don't have any goals. But I also don't believe we can be happy if that's all we care about, if it's just about the goal. Let's find the goals that we care about, and we'll talk about how in a minute, and then learn to enjoy the process, thereby raising our base level of happiness. Watson, from the Handbook of Positive Psychology: contemporary research emphasized that it is the process of striving after goals, rather than goal attainment per se, that is crucial for happiness and positive effectivity. And finally, Myers and Dinner, two leading researchers in positive psychology: happiness grows less from the passive experience of desirable circumstances than from involvement in valued activities and progress toward one's goals. It's the process that matters. But it's not just any process. It's a process toward a peak that we truly care about and truly believe in. And whether or not we attain that peak actually matters less than having that to strive for. Gwendolyn Brooks: live not for battles won, live not for the end of the song, live for the along. This is taken from her poem called Speech to the School Children. Just beautiful. So how do we find these goals? These goals that will not only liberate us, but make us happy along the way. I'm going to talk about two factors. One is identifying self-concordant goals, which is in your reading, but I'll elaborate on it a little. And the other is taken from the book, The Question of Happiness, on the three-question process, which is going to be your response paper for after spring break. First, self-concordant goals. What are they? Self-concordant goals are aligned with personal interests and values, whatever your personal interests and values are. It's about finding things, whether it's a career or a calling, whether it's joining a student organization, for the right reasons. It's going for medicine because that is what you're truly passionate about. It's going into investment banking because you're truly passionate and love to work with numbers and want to understand how the market works. It's going into a not-for-profit organization because you believe in the mission of that organization. It's doing things for the right reasons, internal reasons, not externally imposed reasons. Sometimes they're aligned, the external, the internal, sometimes they're not. It's about goals that you choose for yourself. Where you ask, what is it in life that I want to do? They're not imposed. Now, that doesn't mean going against the grain for the sake of going against the grain. Because when we do that, we're being just as reactive as when we do what other people think we should do. It's about identifying, what is it that I want to do? It's about identifying our want-tos versus our have-tos. Why am I going to med school? Do I feel a sense of obligation to do it? Or is it something that I truly care about? Why am I going to investment banking? Is it because it's a prestigious job? Or is it because it's something I enjoy tremendously? Why am I joining a student organization? Is it so that others can see how long my resume is? Or is it because I care about the mission of that organization? Why do I do things? One thing that really helped me identify my self-concordant goals was something that my teacher and mentor, whom I've spoken about before, Ohad Kamin, told me after graduating from college. He usually doesn't talk that way, but he said, you know, this is a special time, so I'm going to give you advice from the perspective of a 50-year-old. He was 50 at the time. And he said to me the following, because we were talking about what am I going to do now. I didn't yet have a job when I graduated, and I wasn't sure about the direction of where I was going. So it was in this context. And he said, Tal, you have to identify the things that you want to do. Ask yourself, what do I want to do? And list these things. And then he says, once you have these things about the things that you want to do, you have to ask yourselves out of them, what are the things that you really want to do? And identify them. So that's a subset. And he says, after you identify the things that you really want to do, you have to ask yourself, what do you really, really want to do? And after you identify that, that is what you need to pursue. That is advice that I've kept, very simple advice, that I've kept with me since. If we have the luxury to do what we really, really want to do, then do it. And sometimes it may mean giving up things that we have to do. It means giving up certain obligations that society is imposing on us. It sometimes means going against the grain, and it's not always easy. But life is too short to do what I have to do. It is barely long enough to do what I want to do. Easier said than done, because there are a lot of external forces that are taking us away from our want-tos. In the research on self-concordant goals, becoming self-concordant is a difficult skill, requiring both accurate self-perceptual abilities and the ability to resist social pressures that may sometimes push one in inappropriate directions. We all go through them, we all have them. I mean, personally, for me, what was difficult moving away from was doing research. As you know, research is not my thing. Yes, I wrote my dissertation. I'm a consumer and a disseminator of research, but I don't do research. And I can't even tell you how many people, people who care about me, said, look, just do some research and then, you know, you can be on the tenure track and your career can be assured. But that's not what I want to do. Maybe it's a mistake, maybe they were right and I should have done some research, but I had this question in mind. What do I really, really want to do? What I really, really want to do is write books, not necessarily academic books, and teach. Again, life is too short to do what we have to do or what we should do. It's not an easy question because there's a lot of overlap between them, but it's a question that you'll get to address in your response paper and hopefully beyond that. I want to share with you now the words of another teacher. Again, it's from a film that had a lot of impact on me in thinking about these very ideas. I'm going to show a brief 3-minute excerpt from this movie. Those of you who haven't seen it, I'm sure most of you have, Dead Poets Society.
It's the opening note, page 542. Read the first stanza of the poem you find. The verses to make much of time?
Yes.
One. Somewhat appropriate, isn't it? Gather ye rosebuds while ye may, old time is still a-flying, and this same flower that smiles today, tomorrow will be dying.
Thank you, Mr. Pitts. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. The Latin term for that sentiment is carpe diem. Now, who knows what that means? Carpe diem, that's seize the day. Very good, Mr. Meeks. Meeks, another unusual name. Seize the day. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Why does the writer use these lines?
Because he's in a hurry.
No, ding! Thanks for playing anyway. Because we are food for worms, lads. Because believe it or not, each and every one of us in this room is one day going to stop breathing, turn cold, and die. Step forward over here and peruse some of the faces from the past. You've walked past them many times. I don't think you really looked at them. They're not that different from you, are they? Same haircuts, full of hormones, just like you. Invincible, just like you feel. The world is their oyster. They believe they're destined for great things, just like many of you. Their eyes are full of hope, just like you. Did they wait till it was too late to make from their lives even one iota of what they were capable? Because you see, gentlemen, these boys are now fertilizing daffodils. If you listen real close, you can hear them whisper their legacy to you. Go on, lean in.
But different.
Spooky, if you ask me.
He don't test us on that stuff.
Oh, come on, Cameron. Don't you get anything?
The only test you'll need to pass in this is your own. So let me talk about some of the benefits of self-concordant goals. First of all, increasing well-being. These are goals of the right kind. These are goals that help us be happier. And again, you don't need to be a rocket scientist or a social scientist to recognize this. If we have goals that we believe in, we're much more likely to be happy along the way. That makes sense. And again, there's a lot of research that verifies this in your readings. People are happier and have higher levels of self-esteem. Having a strong sense of controlling one's life is a more dependable predictor of positive feelings of well-being than of any of the objective conditions of life we have considered. Having self-concordant goals provides us a sense that we, doing what we want to, we have control over our lives. Increased likelihood of success. We're much more likely Remember, stay awake if anyone was sleeping until now. Not anymore. We're much more likely to be resilient when we have self-concordant goals. Why? Because I believe that this is my calling in life. This is where I want to get to. We're much more likely to overcome the brick walls, the ups and downs. What's the interesting thing about self-concordance goals, and I was thinking a lot about it, is that they defy the no pain, no gain notion that we hear so often. Because what self-concordant goals are saying, not only will we be happier if we have them, but we'll gain more. In other words, to match the no pain, no gain cliche, let me propose, do it better with pleasure. And you're not allowed to quote this outside this room because it will ruin my reputation. Do it better with pleasure, but it's true. It's true. We can be happier and more successful if we identify the right goals. What the research shows by Sheldon is that when we have self-concordant goals, we go in an upward spiral of success. How does that work? We have these goals, we're much more likely to succeed. And when we succeed, our self-esteem, our motivation, our levels of confidence go up. We're much more likely to look for more self-concordant goals because it worked. And we're much more likely to succeed and so on in an upward spiral. Similar to Bandura's work, when we talked about under the beliefs lecture, where he says that when we work hard, when we cope, we're more likely to succeed, and as a result of this success, our self-esteem will go up, and we're more likely to cope, succeed, and so on in an upward spiral. And here is the interesting thing that they found. It also has a trickle effect. What does that mean? You see, we can't only do things that we want to in our lives. You know, in teaching, I love to teach. I love to write the lectures. I don't enjoy going over the lecture four times before I deliver it. It gets a bit tedious, you know, after the third time. But it's part of the work. I have to do it if I want to deliver coherent lectures. So we can't have everything want to. Also, there are people, many people in the world, who have no choice. You know, when I came out of college, I needed work. I couldn't really be picky. So I went for the, you know, whoever offered me a job, that's where I went. I had to. But the interesting thing that they show in the research about the trickle effect is that even if we're able to identify a tiny part of our day or of our week where we do self-concordant things, things that we believe in, that we care about, that has a trickle effect and we actually do better in other areas of our lives. So a single mom who has to work to bring food to her children. If she's able to identify over the weekends, maybe 2 hours or 3 hours of work that she truly cares about, whether it's working with a homeless shelter or spending time with her kids, which is incredibly meaningful to her, which makes life worth living, that has a trickle effect, and she actually will do better in the rest of her life. Not ideal, of course, in a perfect world, we would all be self-concording, so to speak. But even if we identify a little bit over the weekend, during the week, an hour a day of reading a poet we truly love, watching a film we really care about, that can make all the difference. This is the happiness boosters that I talk about in my book. Here is them about trickle effect, the research. Individuals pursuing self-concordant goals were ultimately able to exceed the level of academic achievement predicted by their ACT scores, even though most goals were not directly class or grade related. This finding suggests that those people who can identify sets of goals that well represent their implicit interests and values are indeed able to function more efficiently, flexibly, and integratively across all areas of their lives. Remarkable results. So you may be taking a class that you're not so happy about, but if you participate in an extracurricular activity that you truly care about, that will have an effect and you will actually do better while you'll have more energy. You'll be overall happier, more creative as a result of it. There is a trickle effect, which is significant to remember because no one can live a fully self-concordant life. Finally, benefits to health. What I'm going to describe now is one of the most important studies ever conducted in psychology. The fact that every person on the street doesn't know the study is a travesty to my mind and goes back to the point from the very first lecture, we need more practical idealists, people who want to do good and people who know, who understand the science behind doing good. So let me describe this scientific study run by our very own Professor Ellen Langer. She went into an old age home and divided the old age home into two parts randomly. One part, one floor, was given the following treatment. They were going to get everything that they wanted, their every wish catered for. They were going to be taken care of. Their beds were going to be made for them. Their plants were going to be watered for them. They were going to be given the foods were going to be all made for them automatically. The best five-star service. The second group, the old age home, got a different treatment. They didn't get everything. They had to ask for what they wanted and to get it. They wanted a plant in the room, that's fine, but you've got to water it. You've got to take care of it. You want extra food, you need to take care of that. You want to read a book, we'll get you the book, but you need to tell us. You know, the books are not just going to be there in the library ready for you. In other words, they were focusing on the things that they wanted, and then they went out and got them. Now look at the difference 18 months later when Professor Langer went back into the old age home. Those who got their want to, as opposed to getting all their needs catered, were happier, were more cheerful, less likely to be depressed, healthier, more vital, as evaluated both by themselves and by the nurses working in that old age home. And here is the most amazing result of this study and why everyone needs to know about this. The group that had the want-tos, that they had to ask for what they wanted, they had to think about it and go and get it, 18 months later were twice as likely to be alive after 18 months with a simple intervention. You see, we weren't made to just be there and have all our needs catered for us. We were made to work hard. We were made to identify the things that we want to and then go and get them. The journey, the process is important, as well as the self-concordant goals at the end. Every home should know that because changing our lives from have-tos to want-tos can transform a life, not just of 80-year-olds, but also of 20-year-olds. This indirect evidence for the need for self-concordance goals. Where does the indirect evidence come from? Remember, we talked about external circumstances not having an influence mostly on our lives, except for extreme circumstances. But there are some exceptions. One exception is that people living in a democracy are overall happier than people living under a dictatorship, under communism, under fascism. What is the major difference in these two regimes? In a free society, you can choose. You can do what you want to within reason. You can do what you want to do. Under oppressive regimes, dictatorships, they tell you mostly what you're going to do. And that makes all the difference. Psychologists distinguish between three kinds of orientations toward work. And this is very much relevant to self-concordant goals. People can see work as a job, as a career, or as a calling. Let's look at the grid and see how each one plays itself out when it comes to how we're motivated, to what we perceive work as, to our expectations from work, and what do we look forward to. In terms of a job, our motivation is the paycheck at the end of the month. We see it mostly as a chore, as a necessity, something we have to do. The expectation, not much beyond what I said earlier, the paycheck at the end of the month. Looking forward to TGIF, the end of the week, the vacation. Then there are some people who look at their work as a career. Their motivation, money and advancement. The work, usually the rat race. Let me get to the next stage. The expectations, prestige, power. Our status or the state of our bank account. Looking forward to the next step, the next promotion, then I'll be happy. And the next one after that, and so on and so on. Living in the rat race. And then there are people, not many, but a significant minority of people, who perceive their work as a calling. The motivation is the work itself. These are the self-concordant goals, goals that I care about, that are interesting to me, that are personally meaningful to me. What do I perceive work as? It's a mission. It's a vocation. Vocation from the word voice. I found my own voice. This is what I want to do with my life. I'm passionate about it. I feel privileged to be able to do it. My expectations, to make the world a better place, to derive fulfillment from it, and so on. And finally, what do I look forward to? More of it. This doesn't mean that people who perceive their work as calling don't go through difficult periods. It doesn't mean when there are days when they don't want to get out of bed. I'm talking about a general orientation. And it's a real luxury to find, to identify work that we're truly passionate about. Abraham Maslow looks pretty happy here. The most beautiful fate, the most wonderful good fortune that can happen to any human being is to be paid for doing that which he passionately loves to do. Now, the important thing about this model is that these are not three discrete units of analysis. It's a continuum. Again, there are days when I get up in the morning and I have to write a lecture or I have to write, you know, an article, where I don't really feel like doing it, and it feels like a chore. But on the continuum, overall, I'm much closer to the calling, when I talk about my teaching, than I am to career or a job. There are people who cannot afford. Again, my first 10 years out of college, I couldn't afford to pursue my calling for financial reasons. But what I did is find a job that paid well, and in that job, I identified small areas where I did feel it was more of my calling. Over the weekends, I would do things that were part of my calling. It was then that I created lectures, for instance, because I knew that is what eventually I would want to do. And the important thing, again, about identifying areas in our lives where we pursue our calling, whether it's the 2 hours over the weekend, or 5 days a week, or 7 days a week. The important thing about it is that it has a trickle effect, even if it's only for 2 hours a week. And over time, ideally, we want to grow that 2 hours to be more and more and more. So this doesn't just apply to people who have the luxury to go straight to their calling right out of college. Some of you have it, I know, we've spoken. Some don't. That's okay. As long as you identify areas in your lives, islands in your lives, and gradually make these islands into continents. I want to move on to the three-question process. Those of you who have read it know about it. Those who haven't, I'll just say a few words. This is taken from My Theory of Happiness. Briefly, it's about identifying the overlap, the intersection between things that provide us meaning and things that provide us pleasure. It builds on the self-concordant theory. It builds on Freud's theory, where he says that pleasure is the main driving force, and it builds on Viktor Frankl's theory, who says that a man's search for meaning is the most important driving force. What this theory does is combine them. So activities that make us happiest are ones where we experience both meaning and pleasure. For example, a relationship. The ideal relationship is one where we enjoy spending time with our partner, and we also see it as meaningful, something that is important for us, in contrast with just hedonic relationships. It may be fun, but they cannot be long-lasting. Or in contrast with relationships that are not enjoyable, but we see them as meaningful. Overall, that doesn't lead to happiness. Look at work. There are work that, or things that we do, that provide us pleasure, again, hedonic pleasure, but that's not sustainable over a long time. What we want to find are work that is both meaningful to us, that we care about, and also that we enjoy doing, ideally. And what I did was also add a third component, and this is taken from the work of Professor Phil Stone, one of the fathers of the strengths movement. In 1508, we talk about it a lot more, but in the book, you read enough about it to understand what this is about. So the three questions, when we identify whether it's hopefully a calling for us, or things that we want to do, the courses that we want to take here in college, these are the three questions that can guide us. First, what is meaningful to me? What is important to me? What provides me a sense of purpose? What can get me up in the morning? Second question, what is pleasurable? What do I enjoy doing? What is fun? And the third question, and again, the answers are not the same for all three questions. The third question is, what are my strengths? What am I good at? What can I excel in? And the key for identifying our calling, our courses, whatever it is in life, is to find the overlap between or among the three. Let me run through an example with you. Meaning. What gives me meaning, say, is problem solving, working with children, political activism, and music. These things are meaningful to me. What provides me pleasure is sailing, cooking, music, and being around children. What are my strengths? Facility for language, enthusiasm, relating to children, and problem solving. And then what I do, and what you'll do in your response paper, is find the overlap. And again, the list is much longer. Can be little things, you know, gardening, whatever it is you want to put on there. I find the overlap. Political activism, as an example, personally, very meaningful to me. But I don't enjoy it, and I'm not that good at it. It's still meaningful to me. Take another example, music. As you know, I love great music. It's meaningful to me, certainly pleasurable to me. I would have loved to be a singer, but as you heard in my rendition of Whitney Houston 2 weeks ago, it's probably not something I should go into. Not just for my sake, but humankind. So the overlap, say, is working with children. I enjoy doing it, it provides me pleasure, it's meaningful to me, and I'm good at it. The question then is, what happens after that? I go and narrow it down even further. So does that mean I write children's books? Does it mean I become a school teacher? Does it mean I run workshops for teachers and students? And these are the questions that I ask in order to identify as much as possible, what do I really, really want to do? This is just a heuristic. Again, a very technical exercise at times. But many students who took the class last year said that this was the most meaningful exercise they did in the semester. Maybe not the most exciting, but it helped them identify their next step, or their current step even here at Harvard. So, extra point on the final for the person who can pronounce this. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi works on work on flow. What he talks about, we talked about until now about attaining that end goal. What he talks about is, what does the process look like? What kind of goal do we want to identify so that we enjoy the process the most? His work on flow, which you read about this week. Flow is a dynamic state of that characterizes consciousness when experience is attended to for its own sake. Everyone experiences flow at one time or another. For example, think of a time when you were reading a book and suddenly your roommate calls you and you're startled and you realize that 2 hours have gone by. Or when you play basketball and suddenly you look at your watch and you can't understand what happened, or you're in front of your computer writing. Suddenly you realize that your mom has been calling your name 10 times. You're in flow. We all experience this state of consciousness where we do something for its own sake. When we do it, we're not thinking, oh, I'm writing this paper so that I can get a grade, while we're immersed in it. Or playing sports, we're not thinking about the score even, we're just in it. Or reading a book, we're just reading it. We're being. And there are a few characteristics that go along with this state. First of all, we perform at our best, and we feel most satisfied. Csikszentmihalyi says that it's peak performance and peak experience. I don't want to use his language of peak experience because it's not the same as Maslow's peak experience. We can have this for hours every day, especially if we're doing work that we care about. We're highly motivated when we do it, intrinsically motivated. Why? Because this is when we do work that we do not for any other person, but for ourselves. We enjoy it. We're good at it, or we are becoming good at it. So when we climb a mountain and experience flow, we're much more likely to return to that mountain and do it again. If we read a certain author whom we experience flow with, we're much more likely to read that author again. Levels of creativity, a lot of research that shows that. Self-esteem goes up, and we'll talk about it much more in our lectures on self-esteem. That was part of my research and also some students that I've worked with here who did research on self-esteem and flow. We're more likely to be happy. It doesn't make us happy. It's not the same, but it's associated with happiness. Why? Because we're enjoying the process, and we're also more likely to achieve our goals because we constantly improve. Peak experience and peak performance. So flow is good. The important thing about Csikszentmihalyi's work, the most significant thing about his work, and I'm going to go into some technicalities here, is that he gives us actual tools to get there. Actual tools of how we can construct our activities toward that. And what he talks about is that flow is experienced at the intersection where our skill levels match our task difficulty. Take a second grader, for instance, who reads Hello Kitty, the books that I read now to my two-year-old. That person has a skill level higher than Hello Kitty. So they will be somewhere here. and they'll experience boredom. Give that second grader Hamlet to read, and they will certainly not enjoy it, and they experience anxiety and frustration, unless that second grader went to Marvel Collins School, in which case they can handle it. We want to identify the activities that are just above our skill level, that stretch us, that, remember, get us to the stretch zone, not to the comfort zone, not to the panic zone. Panic would be anxiety. Comfort zone would be boredom over time. And the flow idea can provide us a compass, because if it's too easy, if we experience boredom, we can do something about it, such as we need to find more challenge. Bexton, in his research back in 1954, did the following. This, unfortunately, is not a study that you can do now in William James, but this is what he did in his, in McGill. And he brought in college students and paid them to do nothing. Not only did he pay them, he paid them much, much above the market price. So how much are we making now for studies? About $10 an hour? So he would pay them $20 an hour to do nothing. Dream job, right? No. People after 2 hours, sometimes as much as 4 hours, gave it up. And they preferred doing things and make less money rather than do nothing and make more money. We need challenge. It's an intrinsic need. It's an illusion that the ideal life is a life where we don't do anything. Edwin Locke, some of the most important work on goals, says that we need to set goals and rather err on the side of too difficult than too easy. Stretch ourselves. Richard Hackman, professor here, talks about goals that we have 50% chance of attaining. Goals that stretch us. Csikszentmihalyi, the best moments usually occur when a person's body or mind is stretched to its limits in a voluntary effort to accomplish something difficult and worthwhile. Collins and Porras, in a book called Built to Last, which I highly recommend, talk about the big, hairy, audacious goal, a goal that will be very difficult to achieve. They give the example of the goal that NASA set itself back in, or John F. Kennedy set it, NASA, in 1961, to reach the moon by the end of the decade. They weren't sure they were going to do it, but it stretched them, it motivated them. I want to deviate slightly and talk about an idea which I think is very important that relates to the too easy. What we see today a lot of, and it has something to do with what I spoke about earlier, the idea of the rich, the famous, being unhappy. It explains why there is so much depression in this country of plenty. It explains why there are so many privileged people in this country, financially, who are not doing well in the ultimate currency, in the currency of happiness. It explains why, despite the fact that this country is becoming wealthier and wealthier, people are becoming more and more depressed. Why the average age for depression today is no longer 29, that it was back in 1960. Today, it's 14. It explains why levels of depression are 10 times higher today than they were back in 1960. Doesn't explain everything, but part of it. What's the underprivilege of privilege? You see, many of our parents, many of us, have the means to make life relatively easy for the children. And when they make life relatively easy, they want to. I mean, which parent wants to see their children struggle and go through pain in terms of struggling for their goals? Parents want to make it easy. Natural inclination, I want to help my child. I know it, I'm experiencing it right now. But very often, parents are not doing their children a favor by making it easy. by depriving them of the privilege of struggle. One, because when they achieve that goal at the end, it's been easy, they don't feel as fulfilled as if they would have struggled. And second, learn to fail or fail to learn. They haven't failed enough. They haven't struggled enough. And that doesn't build the resilience that is necessary, that is critical for long-term sustained happiness and success. Samuel Smiles, remember him, the father of the self-help movement, back in 1859. It is doubtful whether any heavier curse could be imposed on man than the complete gratification of all his wishes without effort on his part, leaving nothing for his hopes, desires, or struggles. The underprivilege of privilege. So what do we do about it? We get out of our comfort zone. The sooner we do it, the better. We cope with difficult issues. We cognitively reconstruct failures from stumbling blocks to stepping stones. We cognitively reconstruct brick walls from things we need to avoid to things we need to embrace or break. And we look for these things. And when a struggle comes along, we can say to ourselves, it hurts, it's difficult, giving ourselves the permission to be human. And it's important. It is important to form resilience. It is important for long-term success and happiness. And we'll continue on this next time.